Success isn't just about what you achieve. It's about living a life that reflects your values and priorities. Welcome to Engineer Your Success, the podcast that helps you lead with intention and live fulfilled.
Welcome to the Engineer Your Success podcast. I'm your host, Dr. James Bryant, and today we're joined by Lane Kawaoka, an industrial engineer who transformed his career from managing railroad crews to building a $2 billion real estate portfolio. Lane hosts the Wealth Elevator podcast and is passionate about helping professionals build wealth through alternative investments. Lane, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, James.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit more about your background?
Yeah, so I was kind of taught to go to school, study hard. I don't know, must have been good at math and science when I was growing up. But I'll tell you what it really was. Like when I was in high school, back then they just had Google. And so I Googled like, what are like the top majors to go after without having to go to grad school or get a doctorate? And those are all the engineering. So I'm like, I'm going to do that. So, and I call this a linear path, right? Like my parents kind of taught us all the right things, be frugal with our money, and then you get an engineering job, which is a pretty good job. Not going to complain. You're never going to get rich by doing it. But, you know, invest in the 401k, stocks, bonds, mutual funds, buy a house to live in, which I don't necessarily think is maybe the best idea for everybody. But that was kind of, I mean, again, I call it the linear path. I just fell into this job, got an industrial engineering degree from University of Washington, and started to work for the man.
I want you to take us back to your early days when you were working on the railroad. What was it like being a young engineer managing crews of experienced workers?
Yeah, I mean, up to that point, I wasn't a good student, right? I was like a 3.0 student. So I was never really that good academically. And I knew that, right? I had the self-awareness to know that I wasn't going to work for Apple, or I guess I could have worked for Boeing, since a lot of people work, well, my classmates did. But I knew that, like, I wasn't like super intelligent in terms of engineering. So what does a guy do but go into project management and move dirt around? So that's why I started to work for the railroad. One of the good things is they put me in charge of like 30, 40 union labor machine operators. And we were out there in the wild blue yonder, Montana, North Dakota, Texas, Washington, building railroad, sticks and steel. In the dirt. You don't get no more basic than that. So from an engineering instructions perspective, it's pretty basic. Thing hasn't changed much over the years, but it is big on like leadership. And the railroads are constructed off of a lot of the old military Civil War people moved over to the railroads. So they brought a lot of the org structure, the old school conservative leadership styles. That was kind of the world that I got brought up in when I graduated in 2007.
Yeah, and that's really interesting. And so it brings me to a question. What were some of the leadership challenges that you faced when here you're this young engineer, you're there with these railroad crews, you said it was a conservative kind of like project management type background. What were some of the challenges that you faced?
I mean, nobody respects a young kid. I mean, heck, even, I mean, I'm almost like 40 now. They probably wouldn't even respect me today. Like a lot of these guys are like my grandpa's age at the time. And when you work with union blue collar staff, a lot of it is seniority based, not how much degrees you have, not what you know, just time. And I get it, right? I mean, I kind of knew my role. I mean, I was the youngest person there, of the highest seniority out in the field. I treated people with respect and try to be fair, but also kind of in the beginning, it was good for me because I didn't have very much confidence, and it was hard to speak up and lead a freezing my butt in the morning at 6 o'clock morning briefing, talking about what happened yesterday, what we got to improve, any other updates to the crew, doing that day in, day out for my first maybe 5 to 7 years.
What were some of the key lessons from that time that you've carried forward as you've continued to progress?
I think a lot of it was just experience, like, and having the confidence that, hey, at one time I did this and it's pretty daunting. Whereas like if you manage more white collar staff, indoors and air conditioning, it's a lot easier. In fact, different environment, different issues though. People are people though, right? You treat people with respect and you hold them accountable. We had to follow a lot of the labor union laws. And if not, you have union grievances, which you're always going to have to be dealing with as a frontline supervisor. But it also put me in a position where, I mean, I was working, that was like a Fortune 50 company, right? Huge company, a lot of systems and processes, slighted more on the conservative side. So like when we had meetings with, when I was like the junior person in the room in a meeting, I was absolutely told, do not say anything unless you're absolutely called upon. And when you are called upon, shut your mouth and only answer the question, because you're in a room with other higher ups, two or three rungs above you, and your supervisor, your director, manager may not want to reveal a certain thing because it competes with your agenda. So, I mean, I've always kind of understood that when you know who your boss is. And part of that is like, now I run a much smaller organization. It's a very different, but you know, from that was the world that I got brought up in from a leadership management perspective. But also like that was at that time, a lot of companies and ours was like bringing in SAP, moving over from the archaic way of doing things and ordering things and the accounting ways, the ways you deal with your accountant in your department. Like a lot of things have changed over and maybe easier, but it also gave me appreciation for like when I'm the boss now, like I know how big companies did it. So lessons learned, good and bad.
You've spent 5 to 7 years that were there early in your career working for the railroad. What came next for you? At Engineer Your Success, we're here for leaders like you. Leaders who know there's more to life than just checking off accomplishments. Imagine feeling confident in your decisions, clear in your direction, and fulfilled in both your career and personal life. Whether you're looking to build executive presence, master the art of dynamic balance, or lead with a greater purpose, we are here to help you make it happen. You don't have to choose between success at work and fulfillment at home. You can thrive in both. Visit www.engineeryoursuccessnow.com to learn more about how we help leaders like you turn aspirations into action and success into something truly meaningful. Engineer your success, because thriving isn't just for others, it's for you. Welcome back. Before the break, I asked Lane about his next steps after working for the railroad. Let's listen in as Lane talks about this transition.
Well, I eventually realized like my career wasn't really moving forward out there in the freezing cold, watching people pound railroad spikes or laying new tracks or surfacing or undercutting tracks. And I decided to kind of move more into a white collar type of role. But during this time, I was kind of living two lives. I was a couple years in, I bought a house to live in. I was had a good salary. And because I was traveling all over for work at the time, living in hotels, 100% travel, I was in my 20s, so I could do this. I didn't have a family back then. I was able to rent my house out. And that was kind of where I got this taste of cash flow and rental real estate. And I started to get more sophisticated on that side. And this is like 2009. And then because I was in this position where I traveled all over for work for a bunch of years, I was able to put away $100,000 a year to saving on down payments on rental properties. And that was without that job, right? That, I mean, it sucked in terms of quality of life, don't get me wrong. But, you know, to me, your speed on how your real job is not like my engineering job or when I work for the road or the next company. The real thing is focusing on your personal finances at the end of the day, right? How much money is in your personal bank account? And at this time, I was stacking chips up and saving it. And by 2015, I had 11 rental properties, nowhere near like quitting my day job, but these were like the two divergent lives that I was living in, to a point where somewhere before then I'm making more than my boss's boss doing this.
When you think about when you started your real estate journey, were there any fears or doubts that you had to overcome when you first started investing?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of, I mean, I kind of stepped up from one step to another. And in my book, I kind of talk about these steps that investors make when they first buy a property in their local area. The problem is, unless you start at a good time, like how I did in 2009, 2010, you're priced out of your local market, right? Later, what we realized is you got to find properties that hit a 1% rent to value ratio or better. So you take the monthly rental price divided by the purchase price, and you got to be 1% or better. So if you live in a place like where I was in Seattle or California or Boston, you'll be lucky to find a $400,000 rental rent for $2,000 a month. That's not going to work. That's half a percent. We're engineers. We're smart. We can do that mental math on our head. That ain't going to work. That's a horrible rental property.
It is, but how does that translate to fears and doubts? Because there's someone that's going to be listening to this and they're thinking about taking some of the steps that you're taking, but they're facing some fear or doubt.
Yeah, so then I was put up with the situation of like, all right, I can't invest in things in my local area where I can feel it, touch it. If my property manager messes up, I can't go over there and yell at them in person, right? I had to buy properties in Birmingham, Atlanta, Indianapolis, and I didn't even see these properties, nor have I ever been there prior to this. So that's a huge gap right there too that I had to get over. But I mean, the nice thing about engineers, like we look at the numbers, and if the numbers work, the spreadsheet works, and you're able to clear it with a nice safety margin, or people can look up a term, debt service coverage ratio. I mean, you move forward. And also, you also look backwards too, because I think problem with engineers is a lot of us are too analytical and they overthink things. If that's you, also think, all right, I'm investing in my 401k. It goes up 6 to 8%. I get killed with taxes. We know what's going to happen. I'm probably going to be in my late 50s and barely be $1.2 million net worth. That's not enough. You need like 3 or 4 mil. And if you keep going on the status quo, it's just math, guys. Like, I think that's why a lot of investors are engineers, because they sit there and they play at these spreadsheets and they're like, I'm going to be screwed. I better do something different, right? So that, like, I mean, it depends how you're led, right? Some people are led by the carrot, some people are led by the stick. I was kind of led by the carrot. I'm like, well, this is cool, and I was already doing it. Let me take the next step, right? Let me invest in places I'm not even familiar with. I didn't see it, touch it. But maybe the stick was like, well, this isn't going to work. This is not within my timetable.
Okay, so let's talk about your progression. So you started renting out your own house. You were able to stack the chips and then buy some additional rental properties. You were generating income, and then you started to scale. Let's talk about that next progression for you.
Yeah, I mean, the key thing here is like the people you surround yourself around. You are the five people you hang out with most. Up until this point, a lot of people were in the coworkers, even white collar coworkers that made 100 grand a year. You hear the same things: invest in your 401k and do all this stuff. But we know that's what's going to happen, as we mentioned earlier. This is where I got lucky. Like, I happened to interact with accredited investor, people who had $1 million or greater, and they had several rental properties too. And I was kind of the young kid, so I just kind of listened. And what I started to see is a pattern. All these guys, they bought rental properties, and when they got to a certain point, they moved off to larger syndications and private placements because they were tired of being the landlord, right? It's kind of a pain in the butt to have rental properties. And they were moving into these larger syndicated deals. But the problem there is you need to know who the operator and sponsor is to find these deals, find trustworthy people, if that. So the problem is, like, there's no websites for this stuff, and everybody in the cubicles around you are regular people. Harry Potter land, right? And the muggles, in a way. Like, and but I had like seen the other side, right? So these guys aren't faking it, and they're real people. A lot of them were engineers, doctor, lawyers, dentists, but with more gray hairs than I was. So I knew it was possible, and I knew they weren't super smart. Right, they were just passively investing. It just takes a while. So that was kind of where, you know, in a way I got spoiled, right? Or like, oh, there's no going back at that point. I knew it was possible. I knew there was something out there. I just had to educate, and more importantly at that point, get around other passive investors that were had a net worth of $500,000, $1 million or greater, and kind of swim with that group.
Yeah, what surprised you most about scaling from single family to larger complexes when you were doing these syndicated deals?
So I think when you're starting out, you want a lot of control, but then that's where you mess up, right? Because I mean, I was working my engineering job on the side in a way, right? It's kind of funny, like at this time, like the amount of money I was making on the side gig was getting to be more and more. And then, so I kind of went away from the private company, the conservative, high stress, low quality of life company, if you read into that. But I kind of went to more government jobs. And that's, looking back, I'm like, shoot, I wish everybody could do that. They could just find more cruise jobs to work at. And it's all about quality of life, right? And about that time, especially if you get started early, about that time you have kids, like right now I'm having kids, and it's like, that's how life should work, right? Like, but you got to step out and do something a little bit different. Buy rental properties, just getting started. But so I started to work for government agencies. We all know government workers, right? In reality, they know what's up, right? Quality of life. You only got one life there. But if you got passive income rolling in on the side, then you're moving up faster and faster ahead. But this time, what I didn't realize is like all these other investors, more sophisticated investors, were investing in these deals where a general partner operator was at the helm, right? You weren't the landlord, and somebody else, a professional, this is their job to manage the asset, which is effectively what like REITs are and all these big Wall Street real estate investments are, but you're cutting out all these middlemen. You have no idea how much they take out in terms of fees and carried interest. I mean, that was kind of a big aha moment in the beginning. Like when I had a little rental property, it was just a buy and hold. I don't advocate for any house flipping or any kind of that stuff. That's the job. We make good jobs as an engineer. We don't need to do that type of stuff. But when I had just a buy and hold rental, I was making like 20-30% returns a year on my money with the tax benefits, mortgage pay down by the tenant, cash flow and appreciation. And I'm like, well, why the heck would I want to put my money in the stock market 6-8% in this 401k thing? And then you start to interact with all these other high net worth people, and they're like, yeah, it's all a sham. Like, it is? Goodness. Like, the Wizard of Oz is not paying no attention to the man behind the curtain in Wizard of Oz moment.
Yeah, I think a lot of it has to do with the person's knowledge and appetite for risk. Surround yourself with the right people, build that network, and being around people that you can trust. Was there any point in your journey where you failed or there was a setback?
In the beginning, I didn't really take too much risks. I mean, I just buy and held. Later, when we went into larger, more syndicated deals, you go into more value add strategies when you're renovating, but that's why you diversify into multiple projects. And now, certainly now, like now we know the last couple of years, 2021, 2023 was a bloodbath in commercial real estate, went down 20-30%. And that's why you diversify over a timeline of 4 to 7 years. But if you don't risk it, there's no biscuit.
You graduated from school, you were working, and it seems like your mindset began to shift about how to build wealth. And was it just your interaction when you met some of those accredited investors, or was there something else going on?
I think that was the big thing. I'm an introvert and I kind of keep to myself. A lot of podcasts and books, which is a great way to start, I think. But I did that from 2009 to 2015, up until I had 11 rentals. So I did that all by myself. But I didn't really like exponentially take off until I found the right people to get around. So that was a huge thing. I mean, and also like other reasons why, as a landlord, you're on the front lines to getting sued, right? When you're a passive investor, you're just a limited partner. And then you're not the one putting the debt in your own name if people are queasy about going into debt. So your downside as a limited partner is limited there, as the name suggests. That's really how I monetize my stuff these days, is it's the community of other like-minded, more accredited investors, and then masterminding around this stuff. I think starting out, it's, you got to know it's possible.
I want you to take just a moment, one, to talk about your current company, what you do, and the resources like your book.
Yeah. So what we do as a company, we look for good deals out there, because that's the wealth elevator, which is the same as the book and the same as the podcast. What ultimately what I've kind of realized, and I could be wrong, like I just tell my story, and this is the way I got here. I don't give it financial advice. I just tell my experience. But the way I got to where I'm at is investing in rental real estate. At a certain point, I switched to investing in real estate in more of a passive investor syndicated form. But if you were to imagine kind of a diagram, the basement level of the wealth elevator is when you don't even make 50 grand and you're in credit card debt, your net worth is probably under $100,000. I was lucky enough to kind of, I had some student debt, but I had a good paying job. So I didn't really start in the basement, and I had some good financial skills. But the problem out there is all these books, Dave Ramsey, Susie Orman, all great messages, but that's all predicated for those people on that level.
Okay.
When I graduated college in 2007, I was on that first floor of the wealth elevator. My net worth had not surpassed $500,000 yet. So the name of the game, at least what I did, is buy rental properties, right? And this is not a get rich quick scheme. It takes a long time. But slowly you can surpass, become an accredited investor, which is really nothing, that no test for that. It's either you aren't, your net worth is over $1 million, or you make over $200,000 at your day job, or your income is higher than that if you own a business, or maybe even if you include your rental property revenue in there too, the SEC website for that. But once you get to that level, you're kind of more in the second floor of the wealth elevator. And because you have a net worth of $1 million or greater, you have something to lose. You're actually a target for lawsuits at this point. So it makes sense to get away from the rental properties and get to more syndicated passive investments as a limited partner. So you keep doing that, right? And then there's another inflection point where you get to maybe $3 to $4 million. At that point, you could probably put most of your money in T-bills or life insurance and make a nice 3 to 5% return. Life will be pretty good, right? I call that endgame level. But for people who want to journey on and build a legacy, give their kids more than $1 million each, or have this thing keep growing, right? And this is kind of where it's like you choose your own adventure. You're going to need people around you to do this, but we call this kind of the third floor of the wealth elevator. And then there's a penthouse level after that. But as you've seen, like as you go through these different thresholds in life, right, kind of like young adolescence, childhood, young adulthood, like there's different things you learn along the way and strategies, and no different than this. When you're buying a house to live in, when you're doing your retirement accounts, are you even doing retirement accounts, right?
No, I think that is definitely something to keep in mind. So as we look to start wrapping up our time together, what advice would you tell engineers who want to build their wealth through real estate? This could include keeping their day job, just going all out. What advice would you have for them?
You specifically said engineers, and most investors that I've met out there that are accredited have an engineering background. And I think part of that is two things. First, you're never going to get rich being an engineer. Number two, we're not afraid by the numbers. If people want, they can go to my website, download the free analyzer on a rental property, and you guys will be eating that stuff up, right? Like you guys love that stuff. Where a lot of people out there, they don't, right? Even some of my investors, they get afraid by spreadsheets and stuff like that. But the numbers don't lie, right? Like I think we mentioned about fear and uncertainty. I get it, but like when the numbers are what they are and you have a factor of safety built in for an extra thing to break or a tenant to go AWOL on you, trash the property, that stuff is going to happen, but that's what the buffer is there. And sure, there's risk in anything, but when you underwrite properties well, you go into the right things, I mean, you buy more of them, you diversify, I think you kind of understand where you start to hit a better steady state in terms of where the averages will fall. This is the numbers just speak for themselves, right? The returns, and that's how you slowly over time beat what your compadres are doing in the solo, in the 401k world, just merely getting their match and doing the status quo.
So Lane, there are people that are going to be listening to this that are going to be like, hey, I'm really digging what Lane has to say. So what's a way that the listeners will be able to reach out to you or get in contact with you?
Just reach out, lane@thewealthelevator.com. But you can check out my podcast, The Wealth Elevator.
All right, lane@thewealthelevator.com. So Lane, thank you so much for taking the time to drop all of these nuggets of wisdom for all of our listeners to be able to go back and just rethink how they're building wealth. So Lane, I'm going to end this podcast episode like I end every episode, and that's this. Many people know what to do. Fewer people know how to do it. And there's a select group of people that actually follow through. They do it and they're able to create and live the life of their dreams. Lane, I want to thank you for being part of that select few and helping our listeners join their ranks as well.